It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Logan, what did you do?
Charles, the world is not the same as it was. Mutants. They're gone now.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Where is she?
Beneath the stains.
She's like you.
Of time.
Very much like you.
The feelings disappear.
She needs our help.
You are
someone to come along.
Someone has come along.
I am still right here. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as is the usual state of affairs, sitting in the internet room next to me would be my partner, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here again, as always, my friend.
It's a pleasure to have you over there, in here, wherever it is you are. And we have the pleasure today of having somebody who I've been talking to about being on the show probably for about 4 years now, and it finally happened. So we have David Ace Gutierrez with us today. And how you doing, Dave?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on, finally.
I'm very happy that we managed to do this, and I hope this isn't a one and done.
Me too.
So I gave Dave the choice of movies to cover, and he picked Logan from 2017. And I'm going to tell you, I saw this movie in the theater with my kids, and I thought it was an incredibly well-made movie. And when it was over, I said, that was depressing, and I never want to see it again. It was really, really good, but I never want to see it again. It's one of those movies that just kind of fit that mold for me. But since this came up as a possibility for today, I watched it again, and I can tell you my opinion is not quite that way anymore. I felt not as depressed by the end of it as I did the first time we watched it. I found it a little bit more, I don't know, maybe it was watching it on the smaller, you know, 65-inch screen instead of the big movie theater screen. The more intimate way of watching it that made it that way, but it just felt more accessible and not as just downbeat. And the other change is I saw the first one obviously in the theater, but this time I watched it in the black and white version.
I was going to ask, yes.
And I'm curious if you guys have seen either, both, whatever, and what your thoughts are. Because I do have some thoughts on that, and I'm curious. I'm going to hold them to myself until I hear what you guys have to say. So why don't we just start, Sean? When did you first see this?
Midnight showing. I was really excited to see it. I'm a big Wolverine fan. I was hopeful for this one because I felt like progressively the Wolverine movies were getting better as they went along, which is very odd for sequels. It's something that you normally feel that there's a progression. It's usually the progression's the other way. I mean, just we know that usually the best film is the beginning. And I was very hopeful for this one. I knew that it was going to be playing off of some of the Old Man Logan stuff and things like that. So I was kind of intrigued as far as where, or at least, you know, that's what I was thinking. That's where it was going to go. So I was really intrigued. I have seen the black and white version of it, which I think we can talk about that kind of organically as we go in. But this was a film. I agree with some of what you were saying before about this being a dark movie, which is, I think, kind of what you're playing off, at least how it starts.
How it ends.
I've got an intriguing take on that, but we'll get to that as we get to it. I will say this viewing was, for me, very similar to you. I think there's been an evolution, I think, maybe over time as far as this film goes. Always, I will say, out of the gate, this is always a film that obviously I'm saying progressively these films got better. So I'm not going to pull that one back right now, but we'll talk a little bit more as we go forward. Actually, I'm really interested to hear some of David's thoughts because he chose this for this. So I'd like
to know
what drew that.
I saw this opening weekend like yourself, not quite midnight, because I am an older man. And it's interesting that Paul looks like he could cosplay as Logan now that I'm looking at him. He's got that. He's got the hair. He's got the beard. He's got the glasses. All he needs is the suit and the car.
I'm definitely
old. He can be Logan at the weekend. But I'm a big fan. Like you all said, I was hopeful and skeptical going in because, you know, the first Wolverine was just awful. Second Wolverine was good, and then the third act kind of meanders and gets like, what? You can drill into his adamantium holes and steal his immortality? Is that the thing? But the thing that I remember coming out of that movie was one of the characters said that she had foresight as her mutant power, and she said she saw Wolverine dying holding his heart in his hand, which, you know, comes to fruition in this movie. Spoilers. But I love sad movies. I think there's an old Doctor Who adage, sad is happy for smart people. And I think that I am probably I am flattering myself by saying that. But I love depression and sad movies. I think something about, I mean, it's all encapsulated in I'm a big Johnny Cash fan, right? It's specifically the American recordings, those last albums he made with Rick Rubin, where there's just a weight and there's just a heaviness that comes along with maturity and aging and the acceptance of death. And I think this movie plays a lot into those themes that I just love and resonate with me.
And I'm going to give you a little bit of a compliment, sort of, so don't take it too much to heart, but you and I have had some, you know, again, first time we're ever actually speaking in person, but we've sent messages back and forth quite a few times over the years, very often when we disagree on something. And I always accept that you are pretty intelligent because you don't just disagree, you give a reason why you disagree. And to me, that's the whole key to it.
Well, I appreciate that. So, I thought you were going to say that you look like Hugh Jackman. That I said you look like
Hugh
Jackman that way.
You're the younger Hugh Jackman.
More like Professor X at this point.
That too. Yeah, but you're not the 97-year-old Professor X.
Getting there. I'm sorry. I cut you off, Sean. You were going to say
something. No, you're good. You mentioned something interesting there, and you were talking about sad movies. And I also like sad movies. Story is really important to me. I think the tricky balance, I think, with sad movies is the characters have to be likable. you know, has to be, you have to care if they're going through sadness, whatever's gotten there. And I, one of the things I noticed this time around, at least for myself for this film, I found that, I cared about the characters. And that's really, really critical, I think, in this film, if you're going to be giving them this journey, because there's not a lot of happiness for, like, right, all of our main heroes. I mean, there's some key characters pulled from the X-Men franchise, comics and film, that are kind of played out in this one, and they're characters that I care about. To your point about the Wolverine films, they've been uneven. But I needed to, in this one, feel like I cared particular about Logan, but Professor Xavier, Caliban, you know, these are characters that you need to care about along the way based on things that are happening. And I think most importantly, well, not most importantly, but equally important, is Laura, who is for the first time in this one. Because where this film goes, if you do not care about Laura and you do not care about Logan at some pivotal points in this film, you're going to lose something that's going on in this film, because it is very, it can get very dark along the way. So that was something that I noticed this time around was particularly a victory of this film. I cared about them, on both of those characters.
The movie starts off very dark right off the bat with them stealing the tires of his car, and he comes out to stop them. And during the fight, you already see his healing powers aren't what they were. So, you know, he's struggling with just thugs now as opposed to supervillains. So it's, you know, especially, you know, I'm going to go to it, in the black and white version, that really stood out more to me, the dark nature of the beginning.
Do you think you would have liked seeing it in black and white first?
I think I might have, and I'm surprised at that because, You know, I guess it's because of the nature of the movie. Because it's a dark movie, because it's a sad movie, I don't need the bright colors. They're not really adding anything to it for me, because it's not like, oh, we're going to show you this really sad thing, but it's brightly colored, so you should be happy. You know, like that's not going to happen. Right. It's a dark movie, it's a sad movie, and the black and white just kind of emphasized that. So it lets you dive right into it, and for some reason, and I don't know, maybe as we discuss this, I'll kind of have a feel for it maybe better. But for some reason, at the end of the black and white version, I found it very depressing. Whereas at the end of the color version, I found it very depressing. But at the end of the black and white version, it didn't bother me as much. And I think, not that I didn't feel for these characters, not that I wasn't intrigued by them or taking them to heart, but I think the black and white just made me accept the dark nature of it, and not, it resonated, but then I could walk away from it and I could see the other themes. I think there was, you know, you talk about the theme of acceptance of death, but there's also the other theme where, you know, where Laura is effectively his daughter by the time this movie ends, and that he has given to her, and he's started the new community, and there's hope on the horizon for these new batch of mutants. So I think that came out more in the black and white version for some reason than it did in the color.
I'm going to say I think that comes more from a rewatch than the black and white version for you, and I'll tell you why. There's a weird, I'm not trying to make that sound like, I'm going to tell you why you think this way. But
go ahead,
this is
tell
my,
me why I think this way.
This is why I think you might have felt this. Because upon first viewing, there's a real hinkiness with the whole, I forget the name, the sanctuary city that they're going to. That's kind of hard to buy into, I think, at first, especially because it comes out of a comic book and you see that all the coordinates are in a comic book, and it's a Shangri-La that doesn't really exist, right? Except in the minds of these children. And for some reason, this adult doctor who buys into this too. But I think this is one of those movies that upon repeated viewing lets these things sink in and resonate, whereas maybe you're thinking or expecting a superhero movie the first time you watch it. And you see that it's that, but way more. And I think maybe the black and white lets the theme sit with you more than the spectacle. which you get more in color because the black and white's more flat, and it just lets things soak in a little more because you've seen it before.
I think you hit it on the head with the black and white is making you have less of an expectation of spectacle. I think that is exactly the right thought that you're presenting as far as how my mind worked through it. And I think it allowed me to concentrate on the themes more than the expectations. Because I don't think the color added anything to it. So it added expectations that did not come to fruition. Whereas the black and white just kind of let you just ride the roller coaster, so to speak.
Right. Because that strikes me. I'm sorry. Were you going to say something, Sean? I felt like you were.
You're good. You're good.
I felt like the black and white thing was a bit of a, when I say gimmick, I mean that in the purest, nicest way, not in anything, and not in a pejorative, just that here's a different way of looking at the movie. It was never intended to be this way, though. Does that make sense? Like with the Zack Snyder version of the Justice League, it's a nice thing to see and have. And yeah, it could, you know, you could see some breathtaking moments in either one, maybe, if that's what you're into. But I just mean, it wasn't the intent. So it feels like the black and white version, while I love it, it just feels like a gimmick. Like if you buy an acoustic version of an album versus what it was originally put out as, you just kind of see the bare bones as opposed to the meat.
I could see that comparison, but there's a certain rawness to the acoustic version that you're not going to get with the polished version. And I think that comparison kind of plays to this.
Right. But it's not. Sorry?
The Zack Snyder Justice League film, when they released it on HBO, the like Zack Snyder cut of it, they did a black and white version of that as well.
Right.
And I get where you're going with the gimmick end of it. Like, you know, that was clearly done as a gimmick as well. I do think it puts a different lens, I guess, on the film. I think naturally when you take the color away, you're going to pay attention to different things. Just because you're watching the film in a different way. You're right. It wasn't how it was intended, though. I liked the gimmick. I thought it was like a cool idea.
Oh, I do, too.
And I'm not saying you're done, by the way.
Yeah.
I felt like it was really intriguing because I actually watched it this time around in black and white, too, just because of, admittedly, the novelty of it more than anything else. Right. And I found myself paying attention more to the small details that I think I didn't see. This has got to be at least the third time I've seen the film, maybe more. But I know for sure I've seen it three times. And I even noticed, like, when you're talking about in the beginning, like his healing factor and things like that wasn't quite working. I like the tiny details, like not all of his claws were coming out all the way.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this is a man who is clearly, he's like, they established right from the beginning, dude's dying.
I mean, we all, as men of a certain age, we all realize the metaphor of a claw that doesn't extend when it So, yeah, that's, I mean, that's
there's
clear.
That, and then there's also the more extreme Professor Xavier with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
I mean, that's presented as a frightening kind of thing. Yeah. And yeah, it is brilliant. And, you know, this is so loosely taken from Old Man Logan that most of the stuff in here, you know, is original, including that.
Right.
You know, in Old Man Logan, Logan actually is responsible for killing the X-Men while being under mind control. Or was it Mastermind, I think? I'm trying to remember. But whatever the case may be, he's the one who actually kills the X-Men, not Professor Xavier. But to make it that he's got Alzheimer's and he can't control himself, and he's 97 years old and he's feeble, and, you know, he was wheelchair bound before, but he's a lot worse now.
He's just such a surly old man. I love
seeing even the scene where Logan has to take him into the bathroom and put him on the toilet, and he's like, "Leave me, I can take care of myself." And it just seems so real. And that's what I think brought it home, and that's what I think made it more depressing the first time I saw it. But I think, you know, you may be onto something too, that just having had a chance to sit with it and not have the superhero movie expectations going into it, although it has its action moments, obviously. But it's a certainly a different type. It is not your routine superhero movie. It's not cut from the same cloth as most of the ones that you're going to see.
No, it's a parenting movie, and it's really interesting to me, and this is all personal stuff. As my parents get older, I have a child. I'm parenting into directions. Logan has to parent into directions. You know, it's just he finds himself at a place that a lot of people our age are finding themselves at. I mean, it's an extreme case, right? I don't have to inject my dad with something so because he's going to paralyze the city or anything. But
you never know.
You know, I never know. But I have to make sure he's okay. I have to raise an 11-year-old. You know, it's the stakes are so real in this. And I mean, it's elevated, but they're real stakes. They're human stakes. Unlike in X-Men 1, where it's like, oh, you're going to turn the world into mutants, you know, via the Statue of Liberty or something like that. This is a guy who's just trying to get a kid from A to B and make sure that his surrogate father figure doesn't go crazy and doesn't die on him. You know, it's the stakes are fairly low, but like you said, the characterization is so well done and managed that it feels it's the end of the world for these people.
I'm gonna disagree with you on one element of that, in that the stakes in this movie are high, because in virtually every other movie, you never really feel like the superheroes are in true danger of dying. In this movie, I mean, Professor Xavier gets killed and Logan gets killed.
Right.
Spoilers.
Good point. Yeah.
So, you know, the personal stakes are extremely high. And I think, again, that is demonstrated a little bit right from the start when you see that his healing power isn't working the way that it had been in the past. He isn't the indestructible being that could be, you know, basically totally destroyed and is going to come back to life. And it's funny that they played on that a little bit in the Deadpool Wolverine movie at the beginning, you know, where he thinks by pulling his skeleton out, he's going to be able to have it regenerate. And no, that doesn't happen. So it's interesting to see that. I think Hugh Jackman fully intended this to be the last time he was playing Logan. I don't think he ever anticipated doing his encore in Deadpool Wolverine, but I think that just the allure of it was too much fun for him to turn down. But, you know, I think he wanted this to be the final one. They said he had taken a pay cut so that it could be edgy and R-rated, you know, I guess to keep the budget down, because if they had to have the budget be higher, they were going to make a PG movie. So it would have been,
right,
you know, that much less effective with all these themes that we're trying to get at. I thought it was an interesting choice. I'm trying to remember, excuse me, in Old Man Logan, there were various different, you know, villain things that went on, including the Hulk and his offspring. So we didn't have any of that. So in this one, instead, they chose to make basically a clone of Logan, the main, I wouldn't even say villain, but obstacle that they had to deal with.
X-24.
Yeah. And I thought that was interestingly done, and also interestingly portrayed by Hugh Jackman, because he played both roles, and then obviously they did a little CGI to make him look younger. But just I thought the confrontation between the two, and just his being able to just be on the total berserker rage at all times in that character, was an interesting thing. Whereas, you know, he's beyond that now. He's not a berserker rage character anymore. And to see them going head to head and what became of it, I just thought it was just really cool to watch.
Oh, it was a great battle. And the fact that he doesn't even really win it really kind of sings it at the end, I think.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I didn't. Well, it's funny because it's total trope expectations and totally going against them in this basically the same portion of the movie, because I did not expect under any circumstances that Professor Xavier was going to get killed there. So that shocked me. On the other hand, I did roll my eyes a little bit that, oh, the kindly family took him in and now they're going to all be dead. That seemed very, very, you know, that was probably the most cliche thing in the movie.
that was a weird slow spot. Like, oh, okay, so we're going to breathe for a little while with this, with Eric Saul from ER and his family, and this weird subplot about these landowners and recapturing horses and whatnot.
Yeah, it was like they stuck Shane into the middle of it.
Well, it's funny, yeah. Well, they do, because Shane is certainly something they talk about in the movie.
Yeah, they had the scene from Shane, and then they relived it with that family.
Right.
Because that is basically the story where Shane joins Van Heflin and his family, and he fights off the bad guys.
But like your Jaws... Oh, sorry, what were you going to say, Sean?
It was all a vehicle, too, to separate Wolverine from Xavier.
Right.
In order to take it where they did. And I'm not disagreeing with you as far as it wound up being kind of like a slow spot because of what they were trying to do. But, the whole point of that was to separate them, to set up where they ended up going with Xavier. Which was less about the family and more about how do we get Professor X alone in her room. So that way you can't go, why didn't Wolverine do this?
But also the fact that he can't mind read a clone as a clone.
Right.
He mind reads him as Logan, or just really sees him. I get the feeling that his powers are deadened at that point. So he just sees Logan or sees X-24, recognizes him as Logan without the advantage of having his mental powers at capacity at all.
The clone was real interesting to me because of the intensity. It was funny. I look at him, when I look at the early X-Men films, we got to see Wolverine in the Berserker Rage, but that was still the man who was trying to be human.
Right.
And trying to put... This was completely unleashed. It actually kind of reminded me a little bit like Robert Patrick from Terminator 2. Like, just... Its intent is purely on killing. And there is no compassion. There's no humanity. There is no... It's like the beast side of Wolverine. Trying to be controlled by people in a van.
Right.
That part of it was, I think, really interesting to just see, because you don't even really see it in the comics, a Wolverine where there is absolutely no filter, unless there is some form of mind control or something.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's always the battle between the two sides of Wolverine, trying to fight the beast that's inside him. And that clone didn't have any of that. It was interesting to see Wolverine actually almost do a Superman 3.
Right. He has the only way he can rage up is by using that green drug that sustains him, and he kind of ODs on that, knowing that that's going to ultimately kill him. But
yeah,
it's what's going to drive his rage and let him take out all those mercenaries.
Hmm. But he's still not powerful enough to take out his younger self, basically.
Would any of us be, Paul?
You know what you like to think, and probably mistakenly so, that the experienced version of yourself would take out the inexperienced version just by guile alone. And it never works that way, but, thankfully we don't actually have to face our younger selves.
To be frank, this is I watch this movie every Father's Day. I've seen it every Father's Day since it was available on home video. This is my Father's Day movie. It means a lot to me as a dad, I think. I don't know why Wolverine's, as the non-cinematic Wolverine's never been one of my favorite characters. I'm a bigger fan of the cinematic version for some reason. And just like the fact that we can talk spoilers, right?
You got to warn. Absolutely.
Yeah, openly.
I think we've already spoiled some of the biggest parts.
Right. The fact that he dies with Laura is, to me, one of the sweetest moments in tons of movies that I've seen, where he says that's what this is like. Like he finds some happiness, he finds completion in his life, and it's only through effectively his daughter that he finds this. It closes the loop on things for him. Like, this is what it's supposed to be. And maybe I'm romanticizing being a dad, but to me, like, that's what it's all about now. For the last 11 years, that's what it's always been about.
Now, have you watched this with your son?
No, he's 11.
Well, also, it's funny. Sean and I were talking recently about just when it's appropriate to show younger people certain movies. And I am firmly in the camp that it is fully dependent on the child himself and what his maturity level is and what his ability to, you know, to take in the subject matter and handle it correctly. And that's one of our jobs as parents, is to decide when they're able to handle certain entertainment. So I don't know. There are certain 11-year-olds that could probably handle this without a problem, and then there are others not so much. Oh, sure.
I know there are kids like 6 that are Deadpool fans, you know, from the movies. So I'm not gonna. I don't parentally gatekeep in any way, you know. But I know that my kid, he's not into superheroes. He sees when I remember in Avengers Endgame. When Spider-Man and the Iron Man reunited and the tear was streaming down my eye, he said, Dad, come on, grow up. So I don't think this is going to resonate with him at this point in his life, maybe later.
You might have to wait till he's a parent.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain things that, you know, especially if you're not a superhero fan, you wouldn't be drawn to this in the first place. There's two characters, you know, relatively minor characters, but they're significant enough that I had differing opinions, not with regard to the quality, because I thought they were both good, but differing opinions as far as their adaptation from the source material, because I thought they were both very good. I thought Stephen Merchant as Caliban felt to me like he came off the pages of the original appearance of that character. I thought he was great. Right, I loved the way he was portrayed. And then the other one is Boyd Holbrook as Donald Pierce. Now, I always saw Donald Pierce in the comics as kind of a like a fancy boy. And here he's shown as more of like a redneck. So it's very different from what my expectations were. So I'm not viewing him as the same character as I read in the comics, but I thought he was a great character in the movie.
Agreed. They could have used any of the Reavers. You know, it's name only, really. I mean, they could have created a new character from whole cloth that wouldn't have made a difference. It's not like Donald Pierce carries, even for X-Men fans, I don't think Donald Pierce carries such like a heavy weight. Like, I can't wait to see this guy, you know, turn into like, you know, but like Lady Deathstrike is probably the extent of any of the Reavers that anybody cares about.
I thought. I really liked the way he was played as almost being like a Logan fanboy who's doing what he has to do, but admires his animalistic side. And to that extent, you know, seems like he'd want to sit down and have a beer with him instead of fighting him. But, you know, he's got his own job to do. So I thought it was well played because it felt atypical. And I do like in these movies when they, you know, when they can take your expectations and kind of turn them on their ear a little bit.
Yeah, everybody's like the villain, with the exception of, you know, having clones. Everybody's a pretty standard archetypal villain. Like to bring things back to your Jaws movie, for example, the main bad guy in Jaws is the mayor, right? And in this movie, it's Richard Grant. As a sinister scientist that really doesn't like his appearances are few and far between, but they're resonant. And then even his death isn't like one of those hell yeah moments. It's just one of those, okay, this is just to get on with it before we get the X-24 Wolverine battle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the villain behind the true villain, the true villain behind the villain is always a welcome thing for me. So I liked that everybody wasn't an over the top kind of like a Magneto type. Everything is fairly low. Like everything's on simmer in this movie.
Yeah, well, even the villains, if we count the Reavers and Richard Grant, their motivation isn't, oh, let's kill Wolverine. He's just in the way. So, right. you know, we go back to, again, another conversation Sean and I recently had was talking about, does the end justify the means? And in this instance, they go over the top to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. But if they were able to successfully do it without having to destroy things, they would have recreated a new mutant population and You know, the problem is they want to weaponize it, but that's true. A different factor. But just, you know, to restart the mutant population is certainly, I guess, a good goal in this time period and in this existence. But that's, you know, I guess what my bottom line is their goal isn't, hey, let's get Wolverine because we're, you know, because we're villains and he's a hero.
Right.
You know,
the second one.
It's not so clearly that. What did you think of the direction in this by James Mangold? Because I thought this was excellent, actually. I didn't see any directorial missteps in my mind.
Like that shot, are you going to say something?
As a director, and I'll come back to my point in a minute, but as a director, I thought he did a great job on this one. I did not see any directorial missteps either. I think this is a very well put together film. The storytelling in here is really good, with the exception of, actually, I totally agree with the point about the one slow spot was the vehicle that they used to separate them. I feel other than that, the film had a good flow. It had a big story and some themes that we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. But I felt overall this was just a very well put together package. And I didn't feel like there were any weak links in the acting or presentation of the film at all.
No, I think it was really good. I think what's interesting, Mangold is an interesting director in that, probably with the exception of the last movie he did, he knows how to work within the genre he's working it within. For example, like this was like a noir western, and he treated it as such. Like it was shot as such in a lot of like longer landscape shots. He allowed scenes to breathe, but when the action needed to amp up, it needed to amp up. When he did, I think he did the Wolverine movie too.
He did do the Wolverine, yes.
Right. So that took a lot of. You see a lot of Kurosawa influence in that. At the same time, he also managed to incorporate a lot of more modern day techniques. So I think he's somebody who knows the language of film really well and knows how to convey, how to drive the car he's given, if that makes sense.
Well, it's interesting. I'm just looking at his filmography as we're talking. And the first one thing that jumps out at me is back in 2001, he directed Kate and Leopold, which starred Hugh Jackman. I'm assuming Hugh Jackman had something to do with him directing The Wolverine and then Logan, because he
a romantic comedy though. So that's such a weird, but that was a romantic comedy. So they worked together
and he liked him, and yeah. I would imagine he wanted to work with him again. But between that point and when he did The Wolverine, he had done two movies which almost feel like the genres, if you smashed them together, it would almost create this movie or this type of feel. Because he'd done Copland very early on.
Right.
And he did 310 to Yuma, the remake of that movie. And I'm just thinking, like, if you combine those somehow in theme, it almost feels like it would come into, you know, you could almost create this movie out of that genre. But
I totally agree. No, I agree. Like, and Copland was, I think, his first movie?
Second. He did a movie called Heavy, which I'm not familiar with. Yeah, After Heavy.
That was with, anyway, like, Copland was his rise out of indie fandom, right? And when you look at the fact that he managed all those personalities in Copland for his second movie, I mean, he's got Sylvester Stallone, he has De Niro, Ray Liotta, and he turns out this great little crime pick, which, again, small stakes, but great characterization. Just the guy knows how to tell a story.
Yeah, he was also, I'm just looking, he was also an executive producer on The Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
And then his follow-up to this was Ford versus Ferrari, which was another, I felt like, you know, like a small story, but on a big stage kind of thing, if that makes sense. And I think you're right. I think he has the chops to tell the story and not let the movie or the spectacle take away from the story.
Well, what was his last movie, though, Paul?
Well, he's got one in post-production now called A Complete Unknown, which I have no idea what that is.
But the last
movie that was released was Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which I enjoyed.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that you and I don't agree on that one.
I thought it was fine, but this was, I think, the first time I've seen him have a misstep, because it was like he was trying to not, and yet at the same time, channel Spielberg and to like not a successful direction in either way there. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't know that I 100% agree, but I totally get what you're saying and how you saw it that way.
It felt competent, but it didn't feel like a James Mangold movie.
Well, I think you're right. I think there is an element of that he was trying to create it within that world, create that same type of subgenre of action movie. And, you know, I think it's a tremendous challenge to have to do that with, you know, a 78-year-old star.
No doubt.
And I thought he did well with it, frankly. I thought he did much better with that than Spielberg did with the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So,
interesting.
Go ahead.
Just to bring it back to Logan, I just want to say that I can't picture anyone else doing this movie. Whereas with Dial of Destiny, I could see anyone else having done that. Does that make sense?
I could see
his fingerprints are on this movie in a real signature way, I think.
Yes, I could see them having a different director do Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny and have it be comparable. It's not going to be the same movie and not necessarily better, not necessarily worse, but I could see it being an enjoyable Indiana Jones movie. This movie, like you say, he does have his fingerprints all over it. He was, part of the crew that wrote the screenplay for Logan. And I think if you gave someone else, you know, Old Man Logan and said, figure out a way to, you know, put this on the screen, but we're not going to use all the classic Marvel characters in it, I think most people would have come up with a very, very different movie. So I think his fingerprints are all over this.
The film has an interesting reversal in this, because what we're watching in the beginning, from the beginning straight on through to the end, is we're watching a man gradually die.
Right.
We're seeing the physical death. I mean, that's really established very early on. This man is sick. He is dying. But we're also watching a man who is dead inside at the start of the film.
Right.
This is an epilogue to his adventures. He is taking care of Charles out of love and obligation, you know, as far as, you know, the historical piece between the two of them. The job, as far as interacting with people and doing the drive, is really for the purpose of means to an end. I need money. Right. That's really what it's all about. His anger about the car getting shot is that's his job. I mean, that's
his well-being.
Yeah. So that vehicle, any damage to it is impeding what he needs, because he needs to be able to buy drugs, take care of Charles. He would be completely content to stop living life in general and be completely disconnected and actually be in that fortress that they were in himself, if there was any, because he's basically lost touch with who he even is. It was interesting, though, watching him. The moment he was most alive was the end. Really, when he's dying and he's connecting with his daughter at the end, he's the most alive. We got to see him gradually as the film went on, because even I'll challenge the fact that I don't think he wanted to take Laura across country early on.
Absolutely
he
not.
Wanted to get Charles out of there, because that was his obligation. He was leaving Laura behind until things started to happen. He started to realize the claws. He started to realize who Laura was. And sparks started to, I mean, we saw them gradually along the way. Sparks started to ignite with him. He kept fighting them because he was content to keep living like he was dying. But we got to see those gradual sparks. And I think that's something that we can all connect with, you know, as we get older, and that trying to keep alive and keep interested in life and engaged in life. And I thought that was something, seeing where his motivation came from. I liked when he was trying to, he saw Laura following a similar path to him. And, you know, with her powers and with the claws and things like that, knowing that there's killing involved and that that's stuff that she has to live with. And he's trying to mentor her. And through that, he was reconnecting with his own journey and his own life. I just really loved seeing that theme of how internally the man came back to life again by the end. It's so funny to say, like, because I do feel like this was a film that I felt was a lot more depressing in the past, but I do think with each viewing, I find strangely more hope in it as we go along, which I know might seem like a strange thing to see with this film.
I think as the movie progressed, they let you grow attached to the character of Laura at the same time that Logan was. Because when they first introduce her, you know, first they show that she's a little girl, but they also show that she's a maniac killing machine. And I think that's all he views her at when in the beginning. And I think he just views her as a chore that he has to do because Charles has taken this on, and nothing more than that. But then as it's progressing, you start seeing her humanity and it brings out his humanity. And I think, you know, the viewer is doing the same thing. You're warming up to her as he's warming up to her. So I think that was, again, I think that's, I'm going to give credit to Mangold and the acting performances, because I think they all are responsible for bringing that up that way.
Critical scene to start establishing that was when she was first in the back of the car with Charles. Subtle. She's jumping over the back where the window is and shielding Charles.
But to protect him, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just, it was organically she did it. She just, it was instinctual. We had seen her already at that point start to form a connection with Charles, realize that this is a man who is trying to protect her. She's gone through a lot of loss, and this is somebody who's acting like a grandfather figure to her, for lack of a better term. And she jumped over there. I love that scene. I just think it's really, because I will say this. I like X-23 in the comics. I'm not like a huge fan of X-23. The film version of her, I really dig. Like, this was
she's fantastic
for the character. And I thought those sequences made me care about her. I needed that because the film was, to the point of what we're saying, film was very dark early on, whereas I needed that character to root for. And I'm like, oh, I'm digging her. I'm like, this is good. And I think it was a critical balance point to the film. And it's where I think there were some really good choices made in the writing.
I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to piggyback on that, one of the scenes that really stood out for me was when Charles and Laura are alone in the room and he's just explaining Shane to her and he's talking to her about his memory of seeing it. And that's kind of a scene that typically you would think that Logan would have gotten with her, but instead that Charles gets it. And he's building this rapport with this kid that later he kind of transfers over to Logan. So you get to know her and you get a little more about, you can learn more about Charles Xavier in this movie, I think, than you do in most of the X-Men movies. Like with that little scene, you just get a taste of, oh, he was a child once, wasn't he? He was a normal kid. And he's trying to help her become a normal kid. And he's the only one that recognizes, as a teacher, she's just a little girl who's going to have like little kid moments and wants to look just like another little kid. So those little nuanced scenes really played well for me.
I thought that actually starts right from the beginning when she comes around and Charles is like, Laura, Logan, this is Laura. Like, you know, he's like all excited by it. And Logan's like, yeah, you know, big deal. But you could see right off the bat, he's already made a connection with her and that he wants Logan to get it. And eventually Logan does. What did you think of the score? That much. I thought it was kind of subtle, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't really remember much.
I try to purposely pay attention to it for purposes of the show. And I did think that it was subtle. I thought it had a very kind of a feel of bringing the movie along as opposed to giving us a super heroic theme at any point. And I thought that was perfect for the feeling that this movie was trying to portray for us or to create for us. It was more of just like a almost like a downbeat theme kind of going on. But I thought it played well.
Yeah, I didn't have strong feelings about it. That sounds insulting to the score. I don't mean it that way. Sometimes there's scores in movies like this, especially action movies, where like they're almost pretentious, like I've got to be in your face and that type of thing. Right. Whereas I felt like the score here did what it was supposed to do, and it serviced the film, it serviced the scenes. It's not one of those that I was like afterwards going, geez, I've got to go and download that and listen to it. You know, I've got Apple Music. I could. And I often do when we have these conversations, rewatching the movie for the purpose of or even watch the ones we watch for the first time will motivate me to download the soundtrack. And I kind of, you know, live through it afterwards. This isn't one where I was like, I got to go listen to this afterwards. But I also wasn't angry at it, I mean, which there's been movies before where I felt like, geez, a little too much. Like, calm it down a little bit because it's getting in the way of what's going on here. I thought it did a good job. It sounds insulting. I really don't mean it that way because I love the movie. But it's a good soundtrack.
Frankly, I think if the soundtrack had been more intrusive, you wouldn't have enjoyed the movie as much as you did. I think it would have had the perfect balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I often talk about that if you're noticing the score, you know, it's one thing to be trying to listen to it. But if you're not really trying to and you're still catching it, then it's probably too much. You know, it's supposed to kind of help you transition from scene to scene or moment to moment, but it's not supposed to be what you're focusing on, unless, of course, you're going to see a musical.
Right. I'll compare it to something like the Nolan Batman movies, right, where the score seems to be like another character in and of itself, or is really, I guess, how can I put this, is really trying to posit itself as yet another, almost not a visual element, but making itself be known and part of the driving force behind whatever theme or whatever's happening in the scene. I think James Mangold is more concerned with the performances and the visuals carrying the weight of the movie and allowing the music to become almost a tertiary character, just something that you need to kind of fill the space without being obtrusive or even to guide. I didn't feel like music, like in certain food, not, and this isn't a knock on Jaws, but like Jaws has a theme that is a character. It becomes the character, becomes synonymous with a mood and danger. The music here just, it doesn't handhold. It doesn't do much. And it's really like kind of a signature at the end of a painting or something. Like here's the final package with this thing, but it's not going to overwhelm, burden, or shape.
Well, this music present. Is complementary to the movie as opposed to
there you go. That's probably what I'm trying movie. To say. Yeah.
Before it's we get to rating this, any other notes on characters, themes, or anything else?
I just want to say again, like X-23, Daphne, I forget her last name, was just phenomenal. And immediately going with the choice of, and it's manipulative, of an adorable little girl as, like, is she helpless? No, she's a badass in her own right. She can handle herself, was a masterstroke, I think. Had they gone the route of the comics and aged her up to like 13 or 14 or however old Laura was supposed to be in her first appearance, would have been, I think, a disservice to the story, making her under 12, just with this vulnerable appearance, but this warrior spirit, I think, was great. And that kid can acted her way through that movie in such a great fashion.
Daphne Keene was too.
Daphne Keene, thank you.
I agree. All right, so I guess we're at the point where we're going to rate this movie. I'm going to tell you, from a technical point of view, I don't think this could have been much better than it was. I think the themes were strong. I think the execution, the acting, all top-notch. The only area where it truly lacks for me is in rewatchability, because it's so dark and it's so heavy that I can't see myself just popping this on. And you stand in contrast to that, telling me that you feel strongly that you have to watch it once a year on Father's Day. So, you know, I don't know that I have a universal opinion on that. I'm sorry?
I'm in therapy. So that might
I hope that you're joking, but if you are, good luck to you there. but anyway, for me, it's a strong Jaws 2. It's a really good movie. I'm hard pressed to come up with any flaws other than the fact that I feel sad when I see certain parts of it. But I mean, I know I'm meant to feel sad, but I tend to be more forgiving to uplifting movies, for whatever it's worth. I guess I'm an old romantic at heart. But it's a strong Jaws 2, and I could see where people would see it as a Jaws.
I'm a huge Wolverine fan in general, so I want to put that out there first. I will say part of my disappointment as a Wolverine fan has been I enjoyed the movies that were up before this one, and I felt like they, as I said earlier, I felt that they progressively gotten better along the way. There were things that I was like, oh, yikes, why did you do that? Even the one before this one, which went to one of my favorite, thematically was going to one of my favorite story arcs with Wolverine of all time, it had some missteps and misfires that I thought like kind of kept it from being the perfect Wolverine movie. It's so weird to say that this movie, with how dark as it is to me easily the best Wolverine movie, but I think I really, storytelling wise, I think this just did not make. If the only minimal mistake was that one section that it served a purpose in the story to separate the characters, the only slowdown that I really felt was there. And even that, we got a chance to see him like trying to, you know, do a solid to that family and things like that. This, to me, as far as a Wolverine movie goes, it's the Jaws of Wolverine movies. I think if you're going to see one Wolverine movie, my opinion is that Logan is the one you should see, because they finally got it right. And I felt did a complete story that didn't some point in time make something that make me go, yikes, why did you do that? I really wish they'd look at this for anything they tend to do for Wolverine in the future and look at what was done with storytelling here, because this is a really good movie. In and of itself, agreeing that there's parts of it that are dark and depressing, but I like the hope at the end. The man was alive at the end in his own way, and I really enjoyed that one. It made me smile. That's me. But
David, I'm going to give it Jaws. It is by no means as perfect a movie as Jaws. No, it's not as perfectly paced necessarily, but the casting is spot on. The acting's terrific. I've said it before, Hugh Jackman is lightning in a bottle for that character. You could have taken anyone from any one of those X-Men movies, replace them, and you, like 90% of that cast is disposable. But you get Hugh Jackman, you get Patrick Stewart back, and they, as a double team, are just this incredible acting force, and then they bring along this little kid who's fantastic. The story is top notch. I found like very little fault with it. It opens in my hometown of El Paso, Texas, so that immediately skyrockets it. It's one of the best. It's probably one of my favorite movies. And I was going to say superhero movies, but I think that's reductive because it's so much more than that. You know, I think it's probably the best movie that that 20th Century Fox's output of superhero movies ever produced. I think if that was their coda, and that's Wolverine's coda, and I can't think of a better ending for a movie. So that for a franchise, really, because that's kind of spelled the end of the X franchise for those guys, right? Well, Wolverine and Deadpool, but you know what I mean. Like that's as a burial marker. It doesn't get any better than that for me. So total Jaws.
Oh, fair enough. I can't argue with you on that. So, Dave, I want to thank you for coming on. It's been, again, too long to plan in the planning stages to get you on. So let's do this again before so much time goes by.
When you want to talk Highlander, give me a call.
I think that's got to be our next one, because that's the one we actually bounced around for a couple of years that we were going to get to that. So I think that's our next one. Give me a little while to get it into my queue and get it watched, but we'll get to that one.
Can I ask a quick sub question, though?
Absolutely.
Has Deadpool Wolverine affected your opinion of this movie, since it kind of plays around with it a little bit and brings back X-23?
I don't think so, but okay. I saw that as a good, mostly as a good homage to this movie to have her in there, as opposed to really changing my opinion on it. I think my true changed opinion was based on the second viewing. I just felt it was such, you know, again, such a downer the first time that I thought, you know, I still thought it was excellently put together and, you know, all these technical things I was on with. I just didn't like the fact that I felt sad when it was over. And when I rewatched it, I didn't feel quite as sad. So it let those things resonate more.
I echo that feeling, as far as I feel that this film is much better with multiple viewings, like seeing it again, giving it a shot again. I think you notice different things than you noticed the first time through. So I agree with you.
And again, I also think it might have been better watching it at home than it was watching it in a theater. And that's usually, on the movies I can say that about, they're usually movies that I consider to be thought-provoking. So I would say that's the case for that. Again, thanks for coming on. Thanks for joining us for this.
Thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure. And thank you, everybody who is listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.
North Dakota, You took that woman's money. You said you would take the child there.
Where is she?
She's your daughter, Logan. Alkali has your genetic code.
Not just mine.
Logan.
I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it anymore.
Logan.
Just stop.
I have to pee.
Last ride.
I can do this myself.
Yeah, well, you're not doing it. Just get on with it.
Not with you standing there.
Trust me, I'm not looking.
Hello. Hi there. You know you gotta pay for that, right? Hey, where's your mommy and daddy, huh? Come on, that's enough. These two.
Not okay.
Sorry. Do you sell phone charges?